and welcome to episode 126 of the Cricket Her Weekly. We're going to jump straight in this week by talking about a book that Raf has been reading. It's called Unveiling Jazbar, and it's by Ayush Puthran, and it's a history of women's cricket in Pakistan. Raf, tell us about the book.
Okay, well, it's a really important book because it's a story that hasn't been told before, and it is about, as you say, a history of Pakistani women's cricket. And what Ayush Puthran has done is actually go and talk to a lot of the women who have played cricket for Pakistan, and including the Khan sisters, who were really instrumental in the 1990s in kind of first setting up a Pakistan international women's cricket team. But it's just some of the stories that he's dug up are just like very difficult to read, some of them, and really make you think that some of the things that we talk about in the podcast and some of the things that we are often bang on about in terms of pay and the conditions of pitches and things like that just actually are quite insignificant when you read some of the stories about what the women in Pakistan have had to go through in order to actually just pick up a bat. So it starts off with the story of Saba Nazir, who in 2009, so it's relatively recent, 2009, she was a 17-year-old who wanted to play cricket, and she told her mum, and her mum said, "No, you can't." So she was initially defying the wishes of her mum. She then went through lots of different things in order to try and play cricket, including having to walk for miles, not being able to have anything to eat. At one point she went and cut off all her hair because that was the way that she could get on the bus, because then she would be mistaken for a boy. And then her family, that kind of brought shame on the family, because if you're a woman, you're meant to have long hair in Pakistan. And so she went home without her hair, and then her dad like slapped her across the face and said, "How dare you bring shame on the family?" She then caught typhoid, and they refused to take her to a doctor because she had short hair, so they were ashamed for her to be seen by a doctor. And just all of these things happening, and her having to kind of go through all these incredible barriers, and then to end up playing for Pakistan, playing international cricket for Pakistan. And you just think, that's incredible. And that's the story that the book begins with. And then it takes you through the various kind of, the fact that there are plenty of women who are currently in the Pakistan team who have been through similar in terms of family opposition to them playing. The fact that some of that opposition then sort of dies out to some extent when Pakistan is successful in women's cricket. So I think it was in 2010, they won the Asian Games, they won gold, and then they came home to this amazing reception, and a lot of the conservative family members of players who'd been quite anti them playing then sort of came round and were like, "Oh, well, if you're going to get in the newspapers and you're going to have some success, then hooray, that's great, and we're no longer ashamed of you." But just all of those incredible barriers that women had to go through in order to play cricket in Pakistan, and are still going through to some extent, because I don't think that the opposition's completely gone away, although we are in a much better situation than we were back in the 90s when they were facing death threats and having to kind of practice in secret. So yeah, really, really good book. I think my quote on the back sums it up, if I'm allowed to read that out. It says, "Ayush Puthran movingly and eloquently tells the stories of the Pakistani women who have had to fight to play the sport they love in the face of extraordinary societal challenges. Read it, weep for the lost opportunities, and share in hope for the future." So yeah, buy the book. It's good.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, so shall we talk about the 100, Sid?
Yes.
And you have been doing all kinds of things this week. You've been doing lots of jiggery pokery on your computer that I don't really understand, but the output at the end has been these amazing, beautiful charts that you've been producing. Tell us more.
Yeah, I've been working on some new charting tools. People will know that I like to post charts and stats about what's going on in the game and about what people are doing, in terms of, like, this is the the high point of somebody's career or a low point, or you know, this number of runs scored in the power play, things like that. So I love expressing that in charts, and I've been using Excel to do that for many years, but I kind of started to feel the limitations of what Excel was capable of, so I took a leap and decided to go the whole hog and write my own charting tools from scratch.
Wow.
And I've been working on that, and I think we've produced some quite interesting stuff. So we've been producing a chart called the Milwaukee. Why is it called the Milwaukee? Well,
it's because
a Manhattan has lots of tall buildings, whereas Milwaukee, if you've ever been to Milwaukee, only has a few tall buildings.
Okay.
So the Milwaukee just has like four tall buildings, which show you the four quarters of the game, and how many wickets have been lost, and how many runs, or what run rate teams have been scoring up in the four quarters of the game. So that's an interesting one, because it allows you to see some interesting patterns that have been emerging in the 100 this year. One in particular, that teams have been starting off very strongly, and then they've been falling off a little bit in the second quarter. So, typically, the run rate's going down in the second quarter. This is a change from typical T20 and a change from the 100 last year, when the run rate would typically climb throughout the game.
Yep.
So, typically, in the 100 and in T20, the run rate gradually goes up step by step. Whereas here, we've got a step down before more steps upwards. Mm. So, some really interesting stuff coming out of that.
That's great, Sid.
So, check out the charts on Twitter.
And just after we recorded last week's episode of the podcast, so the match that was on Sunday between the Spirit and the Superchargers at Headingley, there was a little bit of controversy. And actually, Danny Gibson tweeted after that match.
Spirit player.
And she said, "The size of the boundary at Headingley today for the women was too small. The women's game has developed so much since the Kia Super League years. And bigger boundaries makes it such a better contest between fielders and batters. It was either four or ones today." Now, you've been crunching some numbers on that, haven't you, Sid?
I have, yeah, and it's been really interesting. So I've looked at the numbers between kind of last year and this year, and all of the batting metrics are up. And we can sort of see that, because we can see the scores are slightly higher this year. One of the charts I've been producing is called a ghost chart, which shows a sort of ghost expression of what a typical score is in the 100 and what the team is actually scoring in the first innings, typically. And we can see that those teams are typically exceeding the ghost score. So we know that runs are up a bit, but everything else is up as well. So singles are up, fours and sixes are up, first innings run rates are up, second innings run rates are up, power play run rates are up, wickets are down, which is a positive for the batting side. Everything's up except twos. Twos are down. So there has been a significant change this year. And essentially, what Danny Gibson said is right, that over the whole competition it's been like that. Now, I think there's an awful lot of reasons for this, and we should stress that the regulations on the boundary size haven't changed. There was an issue at Headingley, because originally they were put out too small.
Yeah,
And
it was just total mistake.
I believe
on behalf
Holly
of
Armitage noticed that and realised that was the case, so good for her, and she asked them to correct that. That led to them delaying the toss a bit. So that did get sorted out, but the boundaries that were played with were within the regulations, and the regulations haven't changed. There's no directive. We're assured that there's no directive from the ECB going they must be small boundaries. You know, that's not the case.
Seems to be a decision that's taken on the day, but by the ground staff, I guess.
Yeah, and in combination with people talking to the teams and things like that. But there's no directive that's come down saying there have to be smaller boundaries than ever before. That's not what's happening. You know, it's a factor of a lot of different things. I mean, one big thing is the fact that we've got all the really top overseas players here this year, which, with respect to the players that came last year, they weren't quite the very, very best. And this year we have got the very, very best.
Yeah,
we're scoring more runs.
Yeah, we're a year deeper into professionalism. So obviously you're going to see even the English domestic players are going to be better. That's just a fact.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think there's a combination of an awful lot of things. But the bottom line is that Danny Gibson was right.
Yeah.
Twos are down despite everything else being up.
That's really interesting, Sid.
Okay. So, yeah, and, but I've had my head buried in the stats. What about, sort of the wider things in the 100 draft?
Yeah.
Let's have a quick talk about that. So, we can see that there's three teams that still have their destiny in their own hands. So, Invincibles, the Brave, and
Phoenix. Yeah, because Phoenix are the top.
Yep. So those three teams are the key ones. They're the ones that look like being the teams that are going to qualify. You wrote a bit about the Invincibles this week, didn't you, Raph? Because you wrote about captaincy. Let's talk about that. Talk about the Invincibles captaincy.
I did. And the controversy or the discussion around this has actually deepened since I wrote that piece, because essentially what happened at the match at the Oval last week was that Invincibles dropped Danne van Niekerk. So you're only allowed to field three of your four overseas players, and they basically said, okay, well, we don't think that she is she is coming back from injury, but there was no injury thing. It was just, we want to play Cap, Ishmael and Susie Bates. So they had Susie Bates as the sort of stand-in captain for that game, and they lost. And so there was a big conversation around that. They then, a few days later, in their next match, also chose to go with the same team. Not quite the same team because Alice Capsey came back, but the same captain. And so they also didn't play Danne van Niekerk. Susie Bates was the step in again. And it'll be interesting to see what transpires for the rest of the competition. But yeah, it was a big talking point and a very strange thing to do, I have to say, quite bizarre, to have somebody who you have hired as your overseas, who, you know, you're paying like a good amount of money to, and for them to do that role, for them to play, first of all, but also to be the captain. And that's been their role, and that was Van Niekerk's role last year, and she did it very well. She led them to victory. To then suddenly turn around one match into the competition and say, oh, well, despite the fact that we won that game, because they won their first match, we think that you aren't good enough to be in our best 11. It's very, very odd. And I was kind of writing about this balance between how you choose your captain, whether you choose them first and then you select the team around that, or whether you choose your best 11 and then you choose a captain from that. And they've obviously gone with that latter approach, but to me it just doesn't make any sense. You know, for starters, it's got to be very difficult if you're one of the players in the Invincibles team to suddenly have that disruption. So there's that. Because, you know, most of them, it's a very similar squad to last year. Most of them played under Danne van Niekerk last year, and most of them talked about how she was such a great captain. And that was one of the key reasons why they believed that they'd won the tournament. So it's not just us saying it. It's coming from the players, people like Alice Capsey. She got on so well with Danne.
Yeah, there's a lot of loyalty there to Danne as a captain.
Yeah, so that loyalty now is kind of sitting there in those players, and they're now confused because that's exactly right, Sid. That loyalty is going to be... so they're going to feel very torn about the situation. The other thing that's obviously going on is that Susie Bates has now got to step in as captain. Now, it's Susie Bates, so she's lovely. She's got a very level head on her shoulders. She's got lots of experience of captaincy. She absolutely knows what she's doing. I don't have a concern particularly, but it's not an ideal situation for her to suddenly be launched into the captaincy when she might well have thought that she would be, of the overseas players, she would be the one missing out. So that's a very difficult situation for her to get to grips with and to establish her authority over the team on the field. And I do think that they've kind of made a bit of a rod for their backs there, and it's a very strange situation. If they didn't want Danne van Niekerk to be captain, or if they had some concerns about her, then they should really have said that quite a while ago and actually established that within the team before everyone got together, rather than doing it like 3 days into the tournament. It just doesn't make any sense to me. If we're on the subject of captaincy, and I'm going to keep banging on about this because I can, London Spirit are one of the teams who are struggling. I think they've played four matches now and they haven't won a single match.
Three
matches, okay, and they haven't won any. Sorry, Spirit. And that has actually, I think that their situation has been made more difficult by the fact that, I mean, obviously, to some extent, they were facing up to Heather Knight, the loss of Heather Knight, and that was something that they couldn't necessarily have anticipated. So it's a bit more understandable. But what they've done is hand the captaincy to a young player, Charlie Dean, who doesn't have a huge amount of captaincy experience, and especially captaincy experience at the kind of level that we're talking, where you've got all of this scrutiny on you. So she obviously did captain Hampshire a few times, but that was in the Women's County Championship when, you know, she's being watched by two people.
Well, you and me.
Yeah. And now she's doing it in front of a crowd of, you know, 15,000. And that is quite difficult. And also, with it being handed to her very much at the last minute, you know, what, got two, three days before the competition started, just being told, oh, you're going to be captain, by the way. And it does seem a bit of an odd one. You know, there are other people around who perhaps, you know, that Spirit could have given it to, who it wouldn't have been such a difficult thing, perhaps. I feel for Charlie Dean, actually. I think that they've given her a really big task, and it's been a big thing for her to get to grips with. So, actually, I was listening to the No Balls podcast yesterday. Kate Cross and Alex
Hartley.
You were
listening to a rival podcast.
That's terrible. No, we listen to our rival. We don't think of them as rivals. We think of them as friendly competition. No, so I was listening to No Balls yesterday, and I find it really interesting to listen to because they often say things on No Balls, and you think, oh, you wouldn't say that to me if I was interviewing you post-match, Kate Cross. So, and one of the things that she said, Kate Cross said, and she's obviously the captain of the Manchester Originals, she said, I really struggle with captaincy during the 100. She basically said, like, I have sleepless nights. I lie awake at night during the 100 thinking, what am I going to do? Who am I going to field here? Like, who am I going to bowl in the power play? And I just thought that was really interesting. And Kate Cross is somebody who is quite an experienced captain, who has captained Lancashire and the Thunder in many other contexts, knows her players really well, and actually even she admits that the 100 is kind of different gravy in terms of captaincy.
The extra level of pressure created by that media and that public, you know, public scrutiny.
Yeah,
that.
So even for somebody who has captained a lot, it's a big deal.
Still a tough gig.
Yeah, so I think that that's exactly right, that they've handed Charlie Dean something that's quite tricky for her.
Okay.
So those are my captaincy thoughts.
And talking of Heather Knight, we've had some big news this week about her, haven't we? She is out of the India tour, out of the WBBL. She's had surgery this week. She's hoping to be back and rehabilitated in time for the 2020 World Cup in South Africa at the beginning of next year. That starts in February, is that right? Runs into February into March, I think. So, you know, and that's going to create so an interesting captaincy situation for England, isn't it, Raph?
Yes, it is. Yeah. Talking of captaincy, this is like the captaincy issue of the podcast. I think that England are going to be a bit concerned about this. And I did write a piece for Cricket Her a couple of weeks ago after the Commonwealth Games, essentially saying that what England have been doing for the last couple of years is a big gamble. They made Nat Siver vice-captain, and she's only a couple of years younger than Heather Knight. They've kind of then, when Nat Siver has been captain, she's been captain kind of in name only. She's not being given it doesn't seem like, from what she says about the plans that are being made, which are all being made by Heather Knight and Lisa Kightley kind of off field, it doesn't really feel like Nat Siver's being given the rope to go out and actually make her own decisions.
Yeah, she remains essentially the vice captain despite being the leader on the field.
Yeah, and I think that has been made, that decision was kind of made almost in order so that Heather, they weren't brave enough to make a decision at the point at which Nat Siver was elevated to the vice captaincy. They weren't brave enough to make a decision about who they thought was going to succeed Heather in the long term.
So it's interesting because when Heather became the vice captain, so they decided to appoint a proper vice captain, and they were like quite explicitly pretty much going, well, we're going to appoint a vice captain and we pretty much expect this person to be the next captain. Now, England under Heather Knight have appointed two long-term vice-captains, first Daniel Shrubsole and Nat Siver, and the appearance is that both of these have been appointed on the understanding that they will not be the next captain. They've been appointed because they're not really long-term rivals to Heather Knight. They're, And we think that that's a mistake that England have made, don't we?
Well, absolutely it is. I mean, it was always a gamble because you never know when you're going to trip over a cricket ball and be out for the next 6 months. And so it's transpired. It was a gamble that let them down during the Commonwealth Games because they then had to go through that that experience of not quite knowing where the authority lay when Heather, it turned out, wasn't going to be able to play in the Commonwealth Games, and they've now got going to have it in the India series when they're also going to have a coach who, in Lisa Kightley, who is disappearing in 4 weeks' time back to Australia. We obviously wish Lisa Kightley all the best, and that's a perfectly understandable decision for her to have made. But it's going to be a very odd series, and really almost what you need at the moment is a coach in place who can make that decision about who Heather Knight's successor is going to be. Because this is the point at which you want to bring them in and say, okay, have a go, be a captain, like do what you're going to do, and let's teach you and let's blood you. And I really wish Heather Knight all the best. Of course I do. And I really want to see her back playing. But we do have to face the fact that this is obviously a much bigger injury than England were making it out to be initially. Perhaps they thought that it wasn't as big an injury as it was. I don't know. This is a big operation that she's been through. It's a big period of recovery. It's possible she may not come back from it. England have to face that. If you're the England management and you're not thinking about that as a possibility, then you're not doing your job properly. So they need to think about, therefore, who is going to replace her, potentially? Who might have to do that? It'll be exactly the same, you would hope, that conversations that Cricket Australia will hopefully be having, the management around the women's team, we'll be having about the possibility that Meg Lanning doesn't come back to international cricket, or that Meg Lanning comes back to international cricket but says, actually, I'd rather not be captain because I'm fed up with that scrutiny. Lanning's deliberately left it open-ended and said, I don't know if I'm coming back or not. So they've got to plan for it. England, they've got to plan for it as well.
Yeah, and Australia actually have done a similar thing to England in a way, haven't they, by appointing Rachel Haynes the vice-captain, who is older than Meg Lanning,
yep.
And definitely not a candidate as a long-term replacement for that reason. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, interesting stuff, Raf.
It is interesting.
And finally this week, the ICC have made a fantastic, wonderful, awesome announcement. The ICC have announced the Future Tours programme, which is going to see an explosion in the amount of women's cricket. There's been fanfares, there's been trumpets, they've been partying in the streets of Wokingham. You must be excited, Raf.
Oh, brilliant, Sid. No, I'm not excited. I am. Oh. I'm sorry. I've burst your bubble there. I'm sorry. I'm about to burst anyone's bubble who's really excited about the ICC Future Tours programme. I think the ICC have played the blinder here, Sid. I'll admit. They've basically managed to create positive PR around an announcement of pre-existing fixtures. I don't really know how they've done it. They've basically got, they've got the ICC work experience kid in to design a lovely graphic that just basically puts, it's a graphic that says Future Tours programme at the top, and it just puts in some pre-existing fixtures for the next few years. And then they've issued it as a press release and gone, ha-ha! We've done something really brilliant for women's cricket.
But there's going to be more tests, Raf. The ICC have announced that there's going to be more
tests. Well, I'm coming to that.
Ah.
Okay, so basically what we've got, the Future Tours programme, is what we've had since 2014, which is, here's the ICC Women's Championship. These teams have to play each other in this window in bilateral series. But we already had that. They also already announced the fixtures for this cycle of the Women's Championship. So they've banged on again about the fact that they've expanded it to 10 teams. Yeah, they have. Yeah, you announced that already months ago. We already knew that. Congratulations. And then the other thing that they've done is they've gone, we've also got all these World Cups. Like, yeah, we already knew they were happening as well. Thanks. You're just re-announcing stuff. Now the test thing, this is the worst of the lot, okay? I cannot believe this. The ICC have had the audacity to try and say, look at our Future Tours programme. More countries are playing women's tests, and they're trying to take the credit for it. It's insane. Literally, like in June, their head honcho went on BBC Radio and said, "No, we don't really support women's test cricket. We don't see that as part of the future." And now they're trying to claim credit for organising more women's tests as part of their Future Tours programme. No, I'm not having it. It's absolute nonsense. Sorry, but I'm actually really cross about this because it's just so It's so rude to, like, the people who can claim the credit for the more women's tests that we've got. So let's just be clear. What we've basically got is India, South Africa, Australia, and England are all going to be playing each other in women's tests on a regular basis. So that means that we're going to have lots of these series, presumably, that are multi-format, points-based. So you'll have one test in amongst three ODIs and three T20s, like the Women's Ashes has been. So it's great, it's great. So Australia are going to play a test in India. South Africa are going to play a test in Australia. And England are playing
in South Africa, probably.
In South Africa and in India, they're playing tests. So it's really exciting. But the ICC, in other contexts, freely admit that it's nothing to do with them whether countries organise tests. Or they try to say it's nothing to do with them. And they say, oh, well, that's up to the cricket boards. Now, if the ICC had anything to do with it, then New Zealand would be playing women's tests. And, I don't know,
West Indies would be
playing women's tests. Because it would have been something that the ICC said, yeah, we're mandating as part of our future tours programme. No, they haven't mandated it. They have nothing to do with it. It's purely a decision that's been made by those four cricket boards. And of course, that's really exciting. And we really applaud those boards. But we do not applaud the ICC trying to take credit. End of rant.
Okay, well, I think that what you need is a nice sit down and a cup of tea after that, Raf.
Yes.
So on that bombshell, we will say goodbye. We will get Raf a cup of tea, a chance to sit down. And we'll see you back here next week. Goodbye.
Bye.